Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks so much for being here with us on this Thursday afternoon. Open forum both hours, 888-318-7884. And there'll probably be a little bit of groovy music at some point. I don't know that for sure, but there'll probably be some groovy music because it's Thursday. Open forum means open to anybody on anything. 888-318-7884. And our guest is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cyril Kellett.
Happy autumn to you. I hope your
Likewise,
autumn is going well.
Happy All Souls Day to you.
Ah, yeah, All Souls Day today. Yeah, we're having a hot All Souls Day here. But
oh,
I mean, not
you?
That it affects the feast. I don't think that has any spiritual significance. It's just a hot day here
okay,
in Southern California.
Well, it is not hot here. It is. I don't know what the current temperature is. I would guess in the maybe it's up to the low 50s by now, high 40s, something like that.
Oh, like a winter night in San Diego.
Yeah.
888-318-7884 is the number if you've got a question for Jimmy Akin. There's two lines open right now. Is the perfect time to dial. Jimmy, what drops tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
We're taking a look at Marian apparitions that started in 1968 in a suburb of Cairo, Egypt, known as Zaytoun. And so we're going to be talking about the Zaytoun apparitions, which actually lasted for over a year. And there were lots of witnesses, like 250,000 people, all different religions and stuff.
Wow.
And there were light phenomena associated with these, and people took pictures. So in the video version at my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Jimmy Akin, we're going to be showing you photographs that were taken at the time of the Virgin Mary and these large things that looked like doves but weren't doves that appeared in conjunction with the apparitions. And we're going to talk about the theories that could explain all of this.
Love it. Is this a single episode one or is this a multi-episode?
Yes.
Single episode one.
Single episode.
Are the apparitions at Zaytoun?
Zaytoun, apparently, is the way it's pronounced locally.
All right. Check it out. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You can find it at mysterious.fm or just type in Jimmy Akin Mysterious World and you will come to it on your Google machine. Again, the number 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Still one line open. Usually 4 minutes into the show, there's no lines open when Jimmy's here. So this is a perfect opportunity for you. We're going to start in Bellevue, Nebraska today. Ricky is listening on Catholic.com. Ricky, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. Hi, Ricky.
Hey, Cy Kellett, Jimmy. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. Jimmy, my question is, I listened a couple weeks ago, I think it was a couple weeks ago now, Trent Horn hosted a debate between two gentlemen, Catholic and non-Catholic, and the subject matter was on, do we need an infallible tradition? I think that was the title. And in the cross-examination, the Protestant gentleman made the claim that Nicaea II, Florence, and Trent all differed on their canonical lists, and I think he even made the claim that they contradicted each other, and therefore he said that that kind of destroyed this notion of ecumenical councils being infallible. So my question is kind of a simple one. One, does everything that's stated at an ecumenical council imply infallibility, or is it only certain aspects of councils that are infallible?
Okay. Well, since you mentioned this debate that you watched, before I give the answer, I've got to do my standard disclaimer whenever people mention something I didn't see, which is, I didn't see it. And so I can't comment directly on what other people said since I didn't see them say it. And I'm always a little hesitant to weigh into such matters because, as the Book of Proverbs says, as a man who takes a passing dog by the ears, so is one who intervenes in an argument not his own. However, and if you can imagine, you see a dog walking by and you grab it by the ears, how's the dog going to react? Well, that's what it can be like when you intervene in an argument that's not your own. Having said that, So the Catholic claim is, number one, there is, I believe you said, this gentleman, coming from a Protestant perspective, referenced Nicaea and Trent. And the thing is, Nicaea, first, neither First Nicaea nor Second Nicaea, which are the only two ecumenical councils by that name, neither one of them produced a canon list. There is a reference in St. Jerome where he talks about First Nicaea having accepted the Book of Judith as canonical, but actually that does not appear in the surviving extracts of First Nicaea. So either they didn't talk about it at all and Jerome was just mistaken, or they may have talked about it and we don't have the passage where they did that. In any event, neither council gave us a definitive list of books from the canon. Also, actually, since Jerome says Judith was accepted by First Nicaea, if First Nicaea did accept Judith, well, then that would show its acceptance of one of the deuterocanonical books that's not in the Protestant canon, because Judith is a deuterocanonical book that's not in the Protestant canon. Having said all that, the Catholic claim is not that councils are infallible in everything they say, just like the Catholic claim is not that the Pope is infallible in everything he says. Both councils and the Pope have the ability to exercise the church's gift of infallibility to be protected from teaching error in a binding way on the faithful. But that ability is not switched on all the time. It has to be specially switched on. And that happens in very circumscribed, limited circumstances when it comes to the Pope. And it happens in very circumscribed, limited circumstances when it applies to an ecumenical council. So, for example, to take the Council of Nicaea as an example, the infallible thing that came out of that council is the Creed of Nicaea, which later was revised at the First Council of Constantinople to become the Nicene Creed that we say on Sundays. But originally, it was a shorter version that didn't go as much into the Holy Spirit, and that was infallible. But none of the rest of the acts of the council, like the 20 canons that survive, none of those are infallible. And similarly at Trent, the things that are infallible are, at least all things being equal, and they're not always equal, but the things that are infallible are those canons, which are little short statements, they're like a sentence long, that that deal with matters of faith and morals. But the decrees that set up for the canons that discuss subjects at more length, those are not infallible. So even within a council like Trent, it's only select things that are infallible. And consequently, even if you found two canon lists by different councils that conflicted with each other, that wouldn't show that there's a problem. That wouldn't show that the church's claims about infallibility are wrong, unless it was claimed that both of the lists were infallible. Well, there have only been two ecumenical councils that was one council prior to Trent that did give a canon list, and that was the Council of Florence, which met in the 1400s. And that council did proclaim a canon list, but it was not doing so under infallibility. When Trent came along, it did, because now there was a major movement, the Protestant movement, that was denying some books in the canon. Trent did reissue a canon list, and for the first time, Trent taught it infallibly. It also affirmed exactly the same books that were in Florence's list. So that was the first time that the Catholic Church addressed the issue of the canon infallibly, and it doesn't conflict with even the prior canon list from Florence, much less does it conflict with another infallible canon list.
And Ricky, I'm going to leave it there because it's time for our first break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Dive deeper into your faith as renowned speakers examine pressing issues facing Catholics today. EWTN takes you to Napa, California for a special two-day event.
Oh, God has His way. God has His providence.
The whole point of the Christian life is love. Love of God and the love of everybody.
The annual Napa Institute Conference, beginning Saturday at 10 a.m. Eastern on EWTN-TV.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. One line open. Open forum with Jimmy Akin, 888-318-7884. Bella is in Washington, D.C., watching on our website or listening on our website, catholic.com. Bella, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. I'm a freshman at a Jesuit university, and where it's kind of like, it's okay to be Catholic, but you don't really want to, you know, actually believe what the Catholic Church teaches. And so I'm trying to balance, how to be humble and have it come from a spirit of love and not just be like a coward and I don't want to be create conflict. So like, for example, today in theology, my Catholic professor, she was talking about like, oh, scholars agree Jesus didn't see himself as God, and like, oh, we can, there's no wrong or right interpretation of the Bible or anything. And then I kind of just felt guilty that I didn't say anything, but then I felt like if I was going to say anything, it would probably just because I was like, that's wrong. So Do you have an advice, like, how to, like, was it, should I have said anything? Like, how do you balance like humility and like it coming out of love when you're just like, not right, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. So this is a situation, or this is a kind of situation that requires a judgment call, because there's no universal answer that applies in all circumstances, and there are competing goods that come with costs that have to be considered in a situation like this. On the one hand, there's the good of correcting what the teacher said for the other students so that they're not misled by it. On the other hand, the students may listen to the teacher rather than you. So even if you try to correct the teacher for the students, for the benefit of the students, that's not guaranteed to have the outcome you want. On the other hand, there's also correcting the teacher for the sake of the teacher. But when teachers say things like this, they very frequently are not really open to being corrected by a student. And so they may not take the correction. They may just reject what you say out of hand. Then there are the things that can happen to you if you do this, especially if you do it repeatedly. On the one hand, the teacher may try to rebuke you in class and make you look bad, and they may have success in doing that in the eyes of the other students. And the teacher, because the teacher is the one with the power to grade you, the teacher may punish you in terms of your grade. And it's a balancing act to try to figure out what you want to do. Ideally, what you want to do is correct when a teacher makes a mistake. You want to correct the teacher, both for the teacher's benefit and the benefit of the other students. But there are constraints on your ability to do that, and you're undertaking an operation that may or may not have success. This is something that, believe it or not, I face somewhat regularly when I take classes, because I've studied a lot of subjects. I know a lot about different subjects, and sometimes I know more about a particular subject than the teacher does. And if I hear the teacher making a mistake, I sometimes let it go if it's not a major mistake, because, you know, I only have a certain number of interventions that I can make before I get branded as, oh, there's that troublemaker, and people, including the teacher, stop listening to me. What I also do is when I make the claim, I want to correct the teacher. I try to be very diplomatic and very polite. I try not to put the teacher on the spot. I try to find a way to give the teacher an out so that, you know, I'm trying very consciously not to humiliate the teacher. I'm trying to save face for the teacher. So, for example, I might say something like, in a case like this, where she said scholars have concluded that Jesus didn't know he was God, I would be inclined to say something like, well, actually, that's not a universal opinion among scholars. There are many scholars who believe that Jesus was aware that he was God. And that way, I'm not denying that, you know, the element of truth that the teacher has, because there are scholars who will say stupid things like that. And so I'm not denying that there are scholars who say stupid things like that, but I'm also not saying it's a stupid thing. And I'm not directly contradicting the teacher. I'm supplementing what the teacher has said. And then another thing that I try to do is, and this is perhaps easier for me as an apologist, I'll have sources that I can name and say, in this case, I could say, for example, scholars like Craig Evans and Martin Hengel and Richard Bauckman and people like that would recognize that the Gospels and the New Testament more generally indicate an awareness on the part of Jesus that he was divine. I could name other scholars like, although I'm having a partial blank on the name, Larry Hurtado would be another one. And it's somewhat easy for me to do that because I have those names at my fingertips. In a case like yours, you might not have those names at your fingertips. And so what you could do is hold your powder for the moment, not say anything in this particular class, but then go do some research and get the facts that you'll want to have to correct what the teacher said. And then you could go back in the next class and ask a question and say, by the way, last time you said this, and I was wondering about that, so I did some checking, and it turns out that this isn't a universal opinion among scholars, that there are many scholars who believe that Jesus did recognize his own divinity, and here are some of the ones I found that believe that. And that way you're trying to present what you're saying as a supplement to what the teacher said, rather than just a "you're wrong" smackdown.
What do you think, Bella?
Oh, that was very helpful. Thank you. I guess it's kind of like sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm just trying to be meek and humble, but it's really just because I don't want to get attacked. And I'm like, oh, I'll just not say anything. So those are great tips. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Well, thank you. I was thinking about sending her a daily defense, Jimmy, but is there a book of yours?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. All right. Bella, we'd like to send you a copy of a book called A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, written by Jimmy, who you just spoke with. If you'd like it, hang on the line and we will send it off to you. Let's go now to, I'm going somewhere. Aaron in Michigan. Aaron, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. I was reading through the Gospels, and I was wondering about the parable of the talents compared to the parable of the 10 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, are we meant to read them the same way? Because the parable of the talents seems more like the king is God, but the parable of the 10 pounds, the king almost reads more like the description Samuel gave of a king in 1 Samuel chapter 8. It just seems one seems more godly and the other seems more earthbound. And I was just wondering if you could help me with that, or if the church had a specific way of looking at it.
So the church doesn't have a teaching about how these two parables are to be understood in relation to each other. It leaves that matter to biblical scholars. And so for people who may not be familiar with these, one of them is found in Matthew and one of them is found in Luke. and they go by different names. Sometimes the one in Matthew is called the parable of the talents, and a talent being a unit of wealth, a unit of money. And it didn't yet have the modern meaning of a skill or ability. And the one in Luke sometimes gets called the parable of the pounds or the parable of the minas or something like that. Pounds and minas also being units of money. And in both stories, a king or is like departing on a journey, and he entrusts different servants with different amounts of his money to manage for him while he's gone. And when he comes back, some of the servants have been productive with the money. They've earned him even more money. But one of them was afraid to use the money productively, so he just hid it in the ground and kept it from being stolen, but he also didn't use it productively. And the king then rewards those who use the money productively and chastises the one who just hid the money and takes that away, takes the 1 pound or talent away from the one who hid the money and gives it to the one that was the most productive. And so that's the basic structure of both parables. And it's clear that these parables are meant to tell the same basic story. And therefore, even though Matthew was meant to be read by his audience and Luke was to be read by his audience, now that we have both Matthew and Luke in front of us, we can relate them to each other. And the standard view among scholars, as far as I'm aware, is that they're basically teaching the same things. We're not meant to draw spiritual lessons from one of them that are not found in the other. They both are basically teaching the same message, but they do get told a little bit differently. For example, in Luke's version, the king is said to go across the sea to receive a kingdom. And this reflects practice in Jewish Palestine at the time, because you couldn't just set yourself up as a Jewish king. The Romans were in charge of the territory. And so if you wanted to be given a kingship, you had to like go to Rome and be granted the kingship by the Roman Senate and then come back. And that happened on a number of occasions. And in Luke's account, Jesus is drawing on that local practice that was native to their time. So people who were listening to him would have understood, oh, he's basing this parable on something that really happens. Kings really do cross oceans in order to receive kingdoms, and then they come back. Another difference is in Matthew's version, Jesus has the king telling the productive servants, I'll put you in charge of many things, but he doesn't really specify what. In Luke's version, he has the king saying, well, to the one who I gave 10 pounds to, now I'm going to put you in charge of 10 cities. And so we have a little bit more detail about how the reward is pictured, rather than just, I'm going to put you in charge of many things. So the details are a little different, and Luke's version is a little more concrete than Matthew's, which may make Luke's king seem more earthly in comparison to Matthew's king. But fundamentally, they both represent principles about how God will reward people or not reward people based on their actions in this life and what they do with the resources that God has given them. So they're a little different in their coloring and the way they're told, but they're making the same fundamental points.
Okay, Aaron?
Oh, yes, yeah, sorry. Yeah, I guess everything that you mentioned, and also at the end in Matthew, like the king sends them to hell, and in Luke, they're killed. And so, yeah, I appreciate your help. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Aaron.
No problem.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Kent in Champaign, Illinois, listening on Holy Family Radio. Kent, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
You're very welcome, and a good day to you. I have a question about how purgatory is described, at least 3 different places in the Catechism of the Catholic Church and many others as well. It's described as a place of punishment. Now, this sounds to me like it was written in order to paint our perfectly loving God as having human limitations, applying a vindictive punishment for disobeying him. Wouldn't it be better to describe purgatory as a place of healing, maybe a spiritual clinic or a hospital?
I'll tell you what, we're going to have to leave that there for a second. Can you hang on a minute, Kent?
Will
we do it? All right, because we got to take this break. Jimmy Akin is our guest. The question is about purgatory. It's open forum. There's three lines open, 888-318-7884. Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore. Visit whyweirecatholic.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
Matt Swaim here. Tomorrow on the Sunrise Morning Show, we'll celebrate the Feast of St. Martin de Porres and get you all the latest news, weather, sports, and a whole lot more. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
I knew it. I knew there was going to be some groovy music today. There it is, a little bit of groovy music for you. Jimmy Akin, our guest, open forum Thursday afternoon. Your call's welcome. 888-318-7884. On the line is Kent in Illinois. And Kent's point is sometimes the church uses the word punishment to talk about purgatory. And he says, wouldn't it be better for us to use more healing words like hospital?
Okay, so one thing that Kent said is that the Catechism says purgatory is a place of punishment. And unless I'm very much mistaken, it does not use the term place. However, it does speak about, and that's consistent with other recent statements from the Magisterium, such as some audiences by John Paul II, where in talking about heaven, hell, and purgatory, he focused on the nature of the experience rather than it occurring in particular locations. So in any event, the church doesn't have a teaching about purgatory being a place. It's certainly not in the sense that we think about places. Having said that, the Catechism does speak in terms of purgatory discharging what it calls temporal punishments. And this is traditional language that has been used for a long time in the church. It goes back, in essence, to the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, the authors of the Old Testament use the image of a king when they're talking about God. He's the king of the universe. And so they use imagery associated with earthly kings that they were familiar with when they try to talk about God. And, well, one of the things that earthly kings do is they reward people who have done good and in their kingdom, and they punish people who have done bad. And so since people obviously do bad, they're going to suffer consequences that are negative for having done bad. And the authors, beginning in the Old Testament, picture that those negative consequences in terms of punishment, where, you know, kings in the ancient world would kill people, they would execute them, they would put them to the sword, or they would beat them with rods, or they would put them in prison, or they would fine them money, or things like that. And so, so because of the historical time period, this image of kingship was very powerful in the ancient Israelite mind, and they used it as a way of trying to communicate what God does. And so that imagery also gets used in the New Testament, and it got picked up by Christians in the early church, and it's been carried down through the centuries to today. Well, more recently, theologians have begun to wonder, to what extent should we take this punishment language literally? I mean, if you do bad, there are going to be consequences that are negative for you, but should we really understand this in terms of punishment, where, you know, you have someone who is having pain or something inflicted on them from outside in a voluntary way, where God just says, the spiritual equivalent of, let this guy be beaten with rods or something like that. And then angels or something presumably take the spiritual equivalent of rods and start wailing on the person. Well, is that really literal? Is that how God would work, since we're told explicitly God is love? Is that really what he would do? Well, a lot of theologians in recent centuries have said, you know, those two images of God is love, which seems to be more fundamental, and God voluntarily punishing people from without, they seem inconsistent. And so maybe that's a sign that we should interpret this punishment language as being non-literal, the same way we interpret references to God's strong right arm or God protecting us with his wings as non-literal. They communicate messages, you know, God will protect us kind of the way a mother bird protects her offspring. God is extremely powerful and therefore he can do anything, that's his strong right arm. But it's not like he's physically, apart from the incarnation, got an arm, and it's not like he's got literal wings at all. And so maybe we're dealing with something similar. When God is depicted as a king, it means he's in charge of the universe. But we shouldn't suppose he literally has a throne that he literally sits on wearing a crown. And maybe this punishment language is another way of talking about negative consequences that God allows to come to people because of what they've done wrong. And this got applied in the first place to hell. And it's very common today, including in magisterial documents, to read about hell as a state of definitive self-exclusion from God, which of course is going to frustrate you. If you cut yourself off or are cutting yourself off from the source of all goodness and joy, well, that's not going to be fun. But you will more commonly find scholars today interpreting this punishment of hell language, not so much as God sending you to a torture chamber, as much as you have cut yourself off from the source of all good and joy. Well, subsequent to that, the same thing has also started to be applied to what happens with purgatory. And beginning in the pontificate of John Paul II, it bubbled up to the magisterial level, where you have John Paul II interpreting the so-called temporal punishments of purgatory as freeing us from our disordered desires. Because in this life, we have disordered desires that tempt us into sin and that make our lives miserable. And we're not going to have those in heaven. So we need to be purified of our disordered desires. And in John Paul II's explanations, he interprets that as being the function of the temporal punishments. They're not so much punishments as they are therapeutic in nature. They're to heal you and help you get over the disordered desires that bring on sin and misery. And so, and that's actually what the Catechism says. It interprets the so-called temporal punishments in terms of therapeutic measures to heal us spiritually. So I think what we see in this whole general area is a kind of development of doctrine that is still in progress. So we have the introduction of new language that says we need to look at the punishments not as voluntary things inflicted by God from without, like tortures, but as a natural unfolding of the consequences of what we do wrong. It's like the definitive self-exclusion of oneself from heaven, or the purification of our disordered desires. But because the church doesn't want to cause alarm and confusion, and because it doesn't want to move too fast, in shifts like this, it tends to go easy and piecemeal. And so that's why in the case of purgatory, the language of temporal punishments still gets used, but now they're interpreted in this newer, more therapeutic way. It wouldn't surprise me at all, though, if 200 years from now, the church has dropped the punishment language in its explanations of purgatory and is instead using purely therapeutic language to talk about purgatory. And at that point, you might find magisterial documents that describe purgatory as a hospital or something like that, or whatever kind of hospitals they have in the 23rd century. But we're not at that point yet because the church moves slowly in these matters.
Okay, thank you very much. It's sort of what I was thinking.
Well, thank you, Kent. Thank you for the call and for the question. I'm going to go to Buckeye, Arizona. I've never been to Buckeye, Arizona, but I sure like saying it. Jim's in Buckeye, Arizona.
Sounds like something that ought to be in Iowa.
It does, doesn't it? Or maybe somebody from Iowa founded Buckeye, Arizona. I wonder. Listening on 810 AM. Jim, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Well, thank you. Jimmy, I've been wondering, when Jesus sent the apostles out two by two, do we know anything about which apostles were sent out two by two or where they were sent?
Okay, so there are two incidents where Jesus does something like this. The first one is mentioned in Matthew, and specifically it's mentioned in Matthew chapter 10. There's a parallel to that in Luke where Jesus also sends out the 12 two by two, but then he also later sends out a larger group known as the 72. And so that would be, 36 teams of two individuals as opposed to just six teams of two individuals. So he actually does something like this twice that we know about. He may have done it more than that. In my memory, I'd have to check the biblical text to see what it says about exactly where they went. In the case of the 12 being sent out, my memory is that this occurs in Galilee. And I don't know that they went anywhere other than Galilee. In the case of the 72, if memory serves, he's getting ready to go to Jerusalem, and he sends the 72 into the villages ahead of him that he's going to be coming through. So they're kind of preparing the way for him to come after them through the same villages. At least I'd have to check, but that's my memory at the moment of what we're given. We do not know about the names of specific villages that they went to, much less do we know the names of specific apostles or others that were sent to those villages. It's kept at a general level. And so we're not given information about the specific itineraries of individual followers of Jesus and where they went.
Well, thank you, though, because it's given me some concern, because I thought I just wasn't finding, and now I guess it's just not there.
It's not there. That's not to say, yeah, that's not to say there haven't been later attempts to speculate about this, but it's not actually in the Bible.
Jim, thanks very much. I looked it up, and the Buckeye part of Arizona was founded by Mally Jackson from Ohio, who named it after his home state.
Okay.
There you go.
Good name.
Yeah, it is a good name. We'll take a quick break. Right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
As the largest religious media network in the world, EWTN has an important role in educating others about our Catholic faith and spreading the good news of salvation. We invite you to explore our numerous pages of historical faith documents, prayers, teachings, and other current issues in Catholicism today. Visit EWTN.com and click Catholicism. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. The store-wide sale is going on, the fall sale going on right now over at shop.catholic.com. Everything's on sale, 10 to 25% off. In some cases, more than 25% off. You don't need a promo code or anything. Just go over to shop.catholic.com and get your savings. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin this hour. Next hour, Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press. The most important press in the Alpha Quadrant will be here, and you are welcome to call with your questions. There's lines open right now, 888-318-7884. I tried to explain to Mark what you told me about the Alpha Quadrant, that it that it divides the, you know, that it split at the
it
point of the Earth.
It divides the solar system, yeah.
But I don't think he quite grasped what I was saying or why that seemed entirely idiotic. It makes no sense.
It does. It's like dividing the Earth by putting the putting the international, well, putting the dateline straight through, you know, a city like Greenwich.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Renee, prime meridian. That's the term I was searching for.
Oh yeah, yeah. Renee's in Virginia watching on YouTube. Renee, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, thanks, and happy All Souls Day.
Oh, thank you very much, Renee.
So, yep, you're so welcome. So my question is, and I want to know if it's okay if I listen to the answer off of the phone so that other people can connect to you. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. So I've been learning a lot about plenary indulgences, and I've been trying to figure out, like, Father Chris Alar gives a good talk about that. But one thing that I'm not hearing in the realm of trying to understand what this is, granted, I know that if you sin, you have to be in a state of grace. You still have to go to reconciliation in order to receive the Holy Eucharist. But when you do the confession and Eucharist, you know, visit a cemetery, whatever, all the little things that are involved in gaining a plenary indulgence, which to my understanding relieves you of the temporal repercussions of having to go to purgatory. If you die, you go straight to heaven. The big question is, when you get the plenary indulgence, how long does that last? A month, a year, till your next sin, or for all your whole life?
Okay. So what an indulgence does is it removes some of the temporal consequences, which have traditionally been called temporal punishments. But we talked about how that term is kind of being understood in a new way today. But what an indulgence does is it removes some of the temporal consequences from sin that remains even after you've repented and been forgiven of the sin. It's kind of like, you know, if a teenager breaks the rules and then repents and comes to you and says, "I'm sorry I did that. Will you please forgive me?" You may say, "Oh yeah, I forgive you, but you're still going to be grounded for a week because you need to learn your lesson." And in the same way, we see God in Scripture, sometimes he'll forgive a person's sin, like he forgave David from for having killed Uriah and taken his wife. But he still indicated that David was going to have to bear some consequences for having done that. And God does the same thing with us. He's like a good father, as the author of Hebrews says. You know, our own fathers just punished us however they thought appropriate, but God punishes us for our own good. In other words, God allows negative consequences to come to us because they're going to help us grow in holiness. And so, so even after you've repented of a sin and been forgiven of it, so you're not going to go to hell, God can still let us have some negative consequences so that we improve and grow spiritually. Well, if you undertake an action like, you know, doing some pious thing to express your sorrow and grow closer to God, like visiting a cemetery or reading the Bible or saying prayers, then it can, just like a parent could say, "Okay, you've been really good. You're not grounded for the rest of the week." In the same way, the church can intervene using the power of the keys that Jesus gave it to remove some of the temporal consequences of sin, provided the person has learned their lesson and no longer needs to have those consequences. And all of this, of course, is ultimately up to God. We don't know exactly how much a person needs, so we can't really, how much a person needs temporal consequences, so we can't put any numbers to this. What the church does do is it divides indulgences into two classes: partial indulgences, which remove part, that's why they're called partial, part of the temporal consequences, and then plenary. The word plenum means full or complete, and so a plenary indulgence would remove all of them. All of the temporal consequences go away. And in order to achieve that, one of the conditions you got to meet is you have to be completely detached from sin. Well, that's kind of a hard condition to meet, but if you did it, if you were completely detached from sin, so you ain't got no more disordered desires, well, you wouldn't need those consequences anymore. And so you would have achieved a plenary indulgence. How long does it last? Well, until you acquire some new negative consequences. So if you slip back into having disordered desires and it leads you into sin and things like that, you've reacquired an attachment to sin that's going to need to be dealt with before you get to heaven, one way or another. It could be dealt with in purgatory, it could be dealt with in this life, it could be dealt with through another indulgence, but as long as we have an attachment to sin, that's going to need to be dealt with. And so a plenary indulgence will last until you reacquire an attachment to sin. Now, as I mentioned earlier, with regard to indulgences, this is an area where I think doctrinal development is happening. In fact, I once was corresponding a little bit with Cardinal Avery Dulles about that fact. And he agreed that, like, we're seeing some new stuff in magisterial documents in this area. And so I think the area of indulgences is undergoing this same shift, because we're re-understanding exactly what's happening in purgatory and hopefully refining our understanding of what's happening in purgatory, that's going to have what the British call knock-on effects, things that come down the line for our understanding of exactly how indulgences work as well.
And that was Renee who asked that question, and she said she was going to hang up and listen, and she did. So thank you, Renee, for the question. I'm going now to Oklahoma. Britton is in Oklahoma listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Britton, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I had a St. Paul yesterday was All Saints Day. We had several relics around the altar at a candlelit mass. And this question's been brought up to me before, but I was thinking about it again, and I had a hard time last time it was brought up to me explaining why we have relics, what relics are, to a non-Catholic without it sounding completely bizarre and like we're a part of some crazy cult.
Okay.
So I was wanting to know if there's a loving way of explaining relics that makes a little more sense to a non-Catholic.
Yeah. So, there is, and what I would tend to do is put them in a larger context, because in different cultures, people have very different ways of honoring the dead. And if you're just trapped in your own culture, like, let's say, Protestant American culture, relics are not going to make any sense to you because it's not part of your way of honoring the dead. But basically, relics are a Catholic way of honoring the dead. And to help Protestants understand this, I would start by pointing out that that different cultures honor the dead differently. In some cultures, what they do when a person dies is they take the body, assuming they can afford it, they take the body, they put it in a tomb. They bury it with spices so that the spices cover up the smell of the decay of the person's body so that it won't smell so bad. And then they seal the tomb and they wait a year and for the body to decay. And then they come back, they take the bones, they clean off the bones, and then they put the bones in a special box known as an ossuary or bone box. And that's actually how they honored the dead in Jesus's culture. That's exactly what they did. That's what Joseph of Arimathea was planning to do for Jesus. You know, they got as far as putting him in a tomb and burying him with spices and letting him alone, but then he rose on the third day. And so his body did not decay and his bones didn't get cleaned and put in a bone box. But that's what they were planning on doing. In other cultures, it's different. In Egypt, now you'll notice the body decays in that situation. That's because it hasn't been embalmed. If you get all of the moisture out of a body, it won't decay. And that's what Egyptians tried to do. So in Egypt, they, instead of letting your body decay and then cleaning your bones and preserving the bones, they would try to preserve your entire body. They had a 70-day process that where they dried out your body using a substance called natron, which is kind of a mixture of baking soda and baking powder and salt, to get all the moisture out of your body so that it wouldn't decay, and they mummified you. And they did other things to you too, but they mummified you. And that's how they honored their dead, by trying to preserve their bodies for extended periods of time, hopefully for all eternity. And that actually was done for the biblical patriarchs, Jacob and Joseph, because Genesis records that both of them were mummified. And so that was an okay way of honoring the dead. In other cultures, they cremate the body. In other cultures, they liquefy the body. In other cultures, they put it up. This is called a sky burial. In some Native American cultures, they kind of build a platform, put the body up on the platform, and birds come and consume it. And so but all of these are just different ways of trying to honor the body. And cultures have very different ideas about how to do this. For example, I was talking to a friend of mine from Malaysia, and in her culture, the way to honor the dead is bury them and never open the tomb again. But here in the West, we open tombs so we can learn about the Egyptians. And it's just our way of honoring the Egyptians to learn about them. Well, relics is a Catholic way of honoring the dead, and especially people who are God's special friends. And so it's not everybody's custom, but it is our custom to help honor God's special friends.
Britton, thank you so much for that question. Hey, if you're on the line, hang on the line. Mark Brumley will be here next hour. We'll continue with Open Forum. If you haven't dialed yet, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, it was all too short, but we'll see you next week, I guess, right here on Catholic Answers Live. Thanks.
See you then.
All right, right back with more Open Forum right after this on Catholic Answers Live.